Welcome to Are We Alone? I am Seth Shostak. Whether something funny about the weather, summers are hotter, rains are more prolonged, and in some places the winter cold isn't enough to freeze the lakes anymore. We'll be seeing more extreme weather as our planet's climate shifts and readjusts to its new dosage of carbon dioxide. So far, this change has been noticeable, but it's also been gradual. But there's another scenario.
Our human-induced warming may trigger a sudden and dramatic shift in climate. Are we close to waking the giant, about to set off a massive and furious response latent in the Earth's climate system? I'm Molly Bentley. Scientists say abrupt climate change is a possibility and point to dramatic climate shifts in the past, but whether it could happen again, we don't know. It's a frightening idea, and it was only a matter of time before Hollywood took it on. Perhaps you saw the movie The Day After Tomorrow.
Okay, picture this. It's just another routine day in the Big Apple. Times Square bustles with businessmen. Subway trains shuttle thousands of tons of protoplasm through dark underground tubes. And the muggers in Central Park eagerly size up prospects. As I say, just another day in New York. But then it begins to rain. Not just a summer spritzing and not even an uncomfortable all-day soaking. This rain goes on and on and then goes on a bit more. It's the biggest downpour since Noah, the most horrific shower since Psycho. The water stalls traffic, floods the subways, and drowns a lot of squirrels. But this is only the damp beginning. New Yorkers, chased indoors and upstairs by the liquid menace, suddenly see a wall of water coming up the avenues. The liquid onslaught washes the city, efficiently clearing the streets of loose trash and any remaining pedestrians. Manhattan is soaked with a tidal wave. That's the mother of all rinse cycles. That, you would think, would be enough to discourage tourism and make it even harder to hail a taxi, but the meteorological fun is just getting underway. A giant cyclonic storm system, thousands of miles in size, is smothering the continent like a humongous pillow, burping cold air into the northeast. Temperatures plummet, and NASA announces to the public that there's a temperature drop in New York of 10 degrees per second. Catch that? 10 degrees per second. Well, at that rate, the mercury in the Big Apple will reach absolute zero within a minute, and that's without the wind chill factor. The snow and ice begin to pile up like junk mail. Pretty soon, Manhattan is knee-deep in the white stuff, but the flakes fall faster than the Dow Jones. Eventually, only the Statue of Liberty's torch is above the snow line. It's Greenland in Gotham. Well, technical quibbles aside, it's a chilling sight to see an ice age hit the Northern Hemisphere in less time than it takes to freeze a quart of chicken soup. And yet, abrupt climate change is the premise in the 2004 hit movie The Day After Tomorrow, a scenario supposedly based on the effects of global warming. But could it happen? Molly asked Richard Alley, one of the world's leading climate researchers whose study of Greenland ice cores has revealed past dramatic shifts. But how do they compare to the drama of Hollywood?
Richard, the popular image of sudden climate change has undoubtedly been influenced by the staying power of the image in The Day After Tomorrow, when all of New York enters a deep freeze in a matter of hours, I think. What is right about this scenario, and what is misleading?
Well, it was funny. I enjoyed the movie. It was a bit funny, and you know, the heroes are larger than life, so the problems must also be larger than life. It's very clear that there have been abrupt climate changes in the past at the scale that if you were living somewhere, you would have noticed that things had changed, and you had to change what you were doing or be in deep trouble. But still, probably years and not quite so big as what actually happened in New York over those few hours in the movie.
Now, you've written that scientists didn't really appreciate the Earth's ability to shift into radical different states until the early 1990s when they started to study Greenland ice cores, which is what you do. How did that change our understanding of what the Earth is capable of?
Yeah, this, again, is one of these stories that very early, people had some glimmering of it. And by the mid-80s, the great geochemist at Columbia, Wally Broecker, was saying, you know, there may be jumps in the climate. We should understand this. And then he and others had helped generate the interest to generate the ability to drill in central Greenland and get really good records of the climate. And bang, it happened. There were lots of these very large, rapid jumps. And I do think it changed the way we look at it. The usual look at climate, and the way climate normally behaves is it's a little as if it's controlled by a dial, a thermostat on your heater at home. You turn the thermostat a little and the temperature goes up a little, and you turn the thermostat a little more and the temperature goes up a little more, and that's fine. But sometimes the climate works more like a switch. You push on it just a tiny bit and nothing happens, and you push it a little more and the switch flips, and you turned on the light or you turned on the heater, and you go from off to on or from here to there in a very short period of time.
You're talking about a switch, not a dimmer switch.
No,
so
this
it
is
doesn't
not a dimmer
gradually
switch. Flip the switch and change the world.
Because our understanding was that the Earth's climate was basically stable and that it didn't change drastically, or at least over a short period of time.
It usually is. As we look back in the ice core record from the last 100,000 years, there are a couple of dozen of big abrupt warmings and something similar of slightly slower, slightly smaller coolings over 100,000 years. So if you picked a random year, the odds are pretty good that climate is sort of behaving itself and it's acting if it's controlled by the dial. But there are years when it's controlled by the switch.
Well, this really gets at how you read and how you take an ice core, which is a bit of art as well as science. It's really amazing what you can do. I wonder if you could just give me a primer on how you take an ice core and how you read it. And these ice cores are really, really long.
The ice in central Greenland or in central Antarctica is about 2 miles thick. And you take a hollow pipe with teeth on the end and you spin it and you cut into the ice and then you pull up a tube, a stick of ice, and you look at it and then you do it again and you do it again until you have 2 miles.
You make it sound like you're pulling out a popsicle. I mean, these things are really long. They're 2 miles long and they're fragile, right? You don't just whip it out and and then look at it.
It is a very careful, very artful turning tube with teeth on the end. The people who do this are really good, and they have to be, because nature is not friendly to you in getting ice out of the ice sheet. And so the ice core drillers and the ice core drills are just wonders of construction, and the wealth of science, the wealth of engineering that goes into this. I gave you a very glib description of something that is to be respected greatly.
Okay, but then you were going to say, and then the technology comes in, and this is what allows you to actually read this long piece of ice.
In the best ice cores, the ones that we love, summer snow and winter snow look different. You can actually, it's like counting tree rings. You can also use electrical properties, chemical properties to see those tree rings. You can check if we count down in Greenland to the year 1783, we know that there was a giant volcano, Laki, erupting in Iceland. We know that Ben Franklin was over in Paris commenting on the blue fogs that were blowing across and suggesting it was a volcano affecting the climate. We'd better find pieces of that volcano in 1783 if we know what we're doing. We do. And so we can count years. The thickness of a year tells you how much it snowed. The concentration of dust or pollen or what have you in the ice tells you what was blowing through the air. And as the snow turned to ice, it trapped little bubbles, and those are bottles of old air that are just sitting there. So if you actually want to know what was the composition of the atmosphere, it's there too.
So the composition of these ice cores really reveals under what conditions they were formed.
The ice cores may be our best window on the past over these times. We clearly use tree rings, we use ocean sediment cores, we use lake sediment cores, cave formations. There's a great number of ways that one goes about reading the history of climate. I like the ice cores.
Well, now when you look back, you've been able to mark sudden changes, abrupt changes in the Earth's climate. Now, just to be clear, we're not talking about ice ages themselves. We're talking about abrupt changes within the interglacial periods. Is that it? Which is what we're in right now.
We've seen the abrupt changes during sort of the slides into the ice age and the climb out of the ice age, and then there was one in the current warm period. Most of them happened while the Earth was either headed down or going up. Most of the time, the Earth was either headed down or going up with the ice age cycling. The analogy that I've I've sometimes used is that the ice ages are a roller coaster and the abrupt climate changes are a bungee jumper on the side of the roller coaster.
Well, let's discuss some of those changes that you've been able to deduce from looking at these ice cores. For example, I think it was about 11,500 years ago, we had this warming period that was pretty abrupt. Is that right? Could you tell me about that a bit?
Yep, there was something called the Younger Dryas. If you go to Europe and you drill a core in the mud of a bog or a lake, you'll find that the pollen, the sticks and things in it at the top are things that live there today. And if you go down, you'll suddenly see indications of tundra. And one of the things that grows on the tundra is this beautiful little mountain flower called Dryas. And so the first time that you see the indications of really cold conditions was the Younger Dryas. And so it's now known from around the Northern Hemisphere that about 12,000 years ago, there was a millennium that was very cold, anomalously cold, and it ended in a sudden jump. And that's the sudden warming that came out of the Younger Dryas. Some people sort of pick that as the end of the Ice Age. And it was big enough that it shows up pretty much in all the records around the Northern Hemisphere. In Greenland, we think it was about 18 degrees Fahrenheit in about a decade.
And I think you've written that that's like going from Minneapolis, where if you've ever survived a winter in Minneapolis, it's pretty brutal, to the conditions of somewhere like Atlanta.
Yes.
I'm speaking with Richard Alley. He's a professor of geosciences at Penn State University and the author of The 2 Mile Time Machine. Well, in a case like this at the Younger Dryas, are the climate changes localized? I mean, could it be warm in Greenland and then cold somewhere else? Or do we assume that then it was warm all over the planet and the abrupt climate change affected the entire planet?
The abrupt climate change probably did affect the entire planet, but it's different in different places. How this thing, we think how it works, is that the North Atlantic is a special place in the Earth's climate. And if you look off of Norway, you can grow roses in Norway because it doesn't get really cold because the ocean does not freeze in the winter. And what happens is off of Norway, in the winter when the surface of the ocean gets cold, the water gets dense enough that it sinks. And then warm water flows up to replace it, and there's sort of a conveyor belt bringing warm water up to off of Norway. And that water sinks, and so it doesn't get cold up there.
This is what's been called either the thermohaline circulation, right, or the North Atlantic heat pump. Do I have that
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Both terms are used for it. And it's very clear that if the North Atlantic were fresh enough, fresh water tends to float on the ocean, if you made the North Atlantic fresh enough that the water would freeze before it sank. And the difference between frozen and having open off of Norway is very large. Once you put sea ice over the ocean, you can go way below freezing, tens of degrees below freezing, whereas when you have open water, you can't get below freezing. And so we believe that at various times in the past, there have been sudden switches in whether the water out there in the Northern Atlantic, what does it freeze or does it sink? Now, when it's sinking, there is a flow that comes all the way up the surface of the Atlantic from essentially around Antarctica. It comes past Brazil. It picks up the sunshine. And some of that flow ends up in Norway sinking in the winter. If you stop that, it leaves sunshine shining in Brazil, it leaves that warm water in the south. And so the cooling in the north will actually give a little bit of warming in the south in a sort of seesaw.
Well, you have these great descriptions of this in your writing. One way to think of the sinking is what happens when you put sugar into your coffee. You just watch it sink to the bottom. And this is what's happening in the north part of the North Atlantic.
That's correct. When salty water gets cold, it's really dense, and then it sinks.
And then one example that you give of what the image of having this circulation stop is like a conveyor belt at the grocery store or something. If you were to jam a fork into the end of that conveyor belt, maybe while the clerk was looking the other way, you could stop that conveyor belt. And in some ways, that's an analogy to what you're talking about.
That's right. In certain times in the past, the coolings were associated with something that jammed it. And the something seems to have been either floods from ice sheet dammed lakes or surges of ice or rapid melting of ice. It was something that put a lot of fresh water out in the North Atlantic in a hurry. Then after a while, conditions changed and the fork got pulled out of the conveyor belt and it turned back on, bringing the sudden warming.
Just this month in the journal Nature on the subject of salinity, a paper came out that said for the first time that the sudden decrease in temperature over Greenland during the Little Ice Age, which we should talk about, has been linked to rapid changes of the salinity in the North Atlantic Ocean. So now there does seem to be a connection between the decrease in salinity in the North Atlantic Ocean and what may have brought on the Little Ice Age.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of people have suspected for a while that the Little Ice Age had an ocean component to it, and this provides support for that.
Remind us what the Little Ice Age was. This is a recent event, and do you consider this abrupt climate change as well?
It's an interesting question, what we call an abrupt climate change, and when the National Research Council addressed this, we came up with two answers. One answer was that it's something that happens faster than the cause. You push slowly on the switch and suddenly it flips. You lean slowly in the canoe and suddenly it falls over. The other one was a change that's fast enough that ecosystems or economies have troubles dealing with it. And it's clear that a whole lot of people lived through the Little Ice Age, and they did just fine. But there were places where the ecosystems and the economies had troubles dealing with it. So the Vikings in Greenland did not like the cooling. They couldn't maintain their lifestyle there. And it's cutting off the trade route. It's cutting off their access to the cultural or religious features that they enjoyed from Europe. And eventually they said, to heck with this, we're out of here, and they left. So it clearly affected them, and so by some definition, it would be an abrupt climate change. What it was a few centuries of generally cold conditions with a very strong signal around the North Atlantic, and we're still sort of arguing a little bit whether it's a global event or not, but the Northern Hemisphere land, at least, was a degree or so cooler during the Little Ice Age than conditions before or after.
Well, then the big question is here, now that we know that this can happen and it can affect humans in pretty drastic ways, the question is what the trigger is and whether or not we are pushing that trigger or triggering that trigger with our own human-made forcing of the climate by adding CO2.
Yeah, well, it's fairly clear that we are making the North Atlantic fresher. We are melting Greenland, and that's putting fresh water in the North Atlantic. People have tried to model this, and so you take what you know about the climate, put in a computer, and then tell it what you think about the future. And the big, complicated models with all the bells and whistles say that the fresh water we're putting in will not be enough to cause a really big jump. People then take simple models, and they say, well, you didn't twiddle all the knobs on your model. Let's work on this a little more, and some of the simple models do some interesting things in the future that we wouldn't like. And so it's one of these things that a change in the North Atlantic is considered unlikely, maybe even very unlikely, but not impossible. You know, if you get in a car and you drive somewhere, you have a best estimate of what's going to happen. You're going to get stuck in traffic, and it's going to take you longer to get there than you'd like. And you have an optimistic view. There'll be no traffic, and you'll get there really easy. And you have a pessimistic view, which is a semi will run over you while you're driving there. Climate forecasting is a little like that. We have a best estimate of what the future holds, and it might be better than that. It really might. We might have overestimated the worries, but there are semis out there. There are shutdowns in the North Atlantic. There are, you know, 100-year droughts. There are ice sheet collapses and so on. And we can't really predict the semis yet. We're working very hard on it, but they are out there.
Richard, thanks a lot for talking to us.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Alley is professor of geosciences at Penn State University and the author of The 2 Mile Time Machine. And now it's time for our regular feature, which you're hearing for the first time this week, Full Wet Sponge. Scientific concepts the public just can't seem to absorb. There seems to be no shortage of such unabsorbable concepts when it comes to climate change. Climate scientist Ken Caldera encounters them at cocktail parties.
Well, one question I get is people saying, well, if you guys can't predict the weather next Tuesday, what makes you think you're going to be able to predict the climate 50 years from now?
And your answer?
My answer is to say that when you want to know the weather next Tuesday, you want to know, is it raining or not? Do I need to bring an umbrella? Whereas when we're predicting the climate for 50 years from now, we want to say, well, an average November day, there'll be 20% of them with rain, and they'll be 3 degrees warmer than the average November day now. And so we're just predicting the changes in the probabilities of different kinds of weather, and we're not really trying to predict the weather.
So if you talk about global warming and you're looking 50 years into the future, it's not that you're saying, well, that Thursday it'll be such and such a temperature. You're saying...
We're saying that that Thursday is likely to be 3 degrees warmer than today and 10% less chance of rain.
What about Michael Crichton? He's thrown a bit of a wrench into the machinery here, has he not?
Yeah, well, he claims that scientists are just drumming up this global warming scare to get research money, and that the media is buying into it because they're trying to sell newspapers and TV advertisements, and the politicians are buying into it just to get votes. And, you know, I don't want to say that everybody's perfect and that there's no bad motivations on anybody's part, but at the same time, the ice caps are melting, the sea ice is melting, the temperatures are getting warmer in most places around the globe, the stratosphere is getting colder, and so the evidence that global warming is real is overwhelming, and just because some people might not be the purest motivations doesn't mean that the facts aren't the facts.
There's another point that at least I hear frequently, and that is, look, climate changes. If you go back 100 million years ago when there were a lot of dinos roaming the landscape, things weren't better then. I mean, are we making a mountain out of a molehill kind of thing?
Well, it's true that it used to be warmer 100 million years ago, and it was colder 50,000 years ago when the ice ages were around. But what's really new about what's happening now is the rate of change. Today, the climate bands, if you think of temperature bands moving poleward as the Earth warms, that for a tree to stay in the same temperature band would have to move 20 or 30 feet a day. And oak trees just can't move like that. Today, temperature is warming about 100 times faster than it warmed when we came out of the last ice age.
Well, what other things do people say to you at parties?
Well, I was at one party, and I was talking about how global warming is going to lead to a mass extinction of the same magnitude as what happened when the dinosaurs became extinct. I said, well, 50% of the species on the planet might go extinct. And the person turned to me and asked, well, yeah, but what does it matter to me? And I had no idea what to say.
Well, you mean they couldn't appreciate the significance of having 50% of the species on Earth disappear. That was okay with them?
Well, I think as long as they had the cow and the chicken and they could have their hamburger and McNugget, they were happy.
Yeah, they seem to be tied in with very few species here. What about their perception of how we might fix this? Do they have any idea about what it would take to avoid this unfortunate warming?
Yeah, I find that most people think if I just drive a hybrid car and I turn off the lights when I leave the room, that that'll be enough to solve the problem. But really, here in the United States, if we're to solve this problem, we need to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions by at least a factor of 10. And these kind of efficiency improvements can maybe get us a reduction of 2, which is important. We can emit half as much of these greenhouse gases with improvements in efficiency. But, you know, there's another factor of 5 reduction that we need to do beyond that. And it really requires a transformation of our energy system. And so all of these actions that people do are good and they're helpful, but it's a long way from being enough.
So is your impression that the public's perception of this problem is adequate to actually address the problem? Are there just things they refuse to absorb that are going to block any progress?
Well, I find that there's 2 types of people that I usually come across. And one is people who say, oh, well, global warming is not a real threat, and besides, it would be too hard to do anything about it. And then there are the people who say, well, global warming is a real threat, and it's relatively easy to do something about it. And I think the correct view is that it is a real threat, and it's hard to do something about it.
Ken Caldera, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Helping us soak up the science was Ken Caldera, a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology, located at Stanford University.
Coming up, a Canadian Inuit takes legal action in the face of a melting Arctic, the day the Earth turned into a giant snowball, and what Butch and Sundance can teach us about what not to do in the face of a changing climate. Hey, after you strip down for the coming hot weather, why not surf onto the SETI Institute's website at www.seti.org and sign up for our membership organization, Team SETI. The cost is minimal. You support the Institute's work and you'll get our nifty magazine, The Explorer. When you do join Team SETI, please send an email to the radio show so we can send you something to cherish. A personally autographed photo of Molly, me, and our numerically small but morally large staff. Perfect for hanging on the wall of your kid brother's bedroom or for wrapping leftovers. So join Team SETI and send us an email. Your prints will come. So, Molly, what's the worst weather you've ever experienced?
Okay, you realize we're chatting in the intermission.
No, we're not chatting in the intermission.
This is the intermission.
No, this is still part of the show.
It's a little bit of the intermission. You've done Team SETI, and we're getting ready for the second half of the show. But the answer to that would be an ice storm in the 70s.
An ice storm?
I grew up in Wisconsin.
Yeah, was it bad?
Actually, this was bad, and this was Wisconsin. Everything froze, the trees, everything. It was incredible.
Yeah, I was caught once in an ugly storm without an umbrella.